It's 3 p.m.
I have a question. From the moment before, the moment die. Looking to find their hands. I'm going to be just the best politicians that I work with. They are at all. Most are. What is that? Like, hey, cool. He goes, everybody. Ha! I wonder if there are. Okay, and we're going to bring them. We're going to let you hear them. We're going to play. We're going to be discussing nation, military, science, health, happiness, defeated, increasing the family health care plan, what? Was this just the last word in everything? Sit down, get a pencil, paper, take the tower, and take the pen, speak. Okay, Count Basie, thank you. This has been my idea. Okay, I double-clicked it. This has been some incredible day. I want to just let you know, I have been going ballistic here. This has been unbelievable. I hope I didn't just bring it up too loud there. It has been unbelievable. We have so many things going on in this state. I mean, if you were a magician or a juggler, you could not juggle and make things happen like they're happening here. Before we get to that, though, let me give you some up-to-date fast facts that are happening. Right now, we got these morons that are trying, the regressive party trying to poo-poo the Buffett plan. Everybody, if you don't know what the Buffett plan is, he's an American billionaire who proposed a tax plan to the president in 2011. And it says that people rich like himself are not paying their share. They pay less in federal taxes as a proportion of income than the middle class. And he says we need to pay our share as wealthy people. And this rule would implement a higher minimum tax rate for taxpayers in the highest income tax bracket. Now, that's one of the things that's happening today. Another one is, it's the start of early vote. I'm broadcasting out of Charlotte, North Carolina. And everybody in Mecklenburg County, you can vote at the Hal Marshall Annex, located at 618 North College Street, first floor. It started today, and it goes through the 27th of April. And then starting April 30th to May 4th, all the libraries will be open. in Betty's Ford Road Library, Cornelius Town Hall Library, the Hayes Building in Valentine, Independence Regional Library, the Main Branch Library, Marion Deal Recreational Center, Matthews Branch Library, the Morrison Branch Library, the Matthews Branch Library, Mountain Island Library, North Country Regional Library, and the South Country County Regional Library, Steel Creek Library, University City Regional Library, and West Boulevard. They will be open from April 30th to May 4th. And we have one Saturday vote, May 5th, from 10 to 1. Now, these libraries will be open from 11 a.m. to 7 p.m. That's their operating hours, okay, from the 30th to the 4th. Also, the Hal Marshall will be open from 8 a.m. to 7 p.m. Today and tomorrow, they're open from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. So get out and vote, and you need to go and vote against Amendment 1. We had Kelly Berry on yesterday explaining to us all the ramifications of this amendment. So we need to make sure you vote against it because it has many, many, many underlining problems that will occur if you do not vote against this amendment. And then we have the Mister. Yeah, the Mister. I tell you what. His budget cuts, I want to tell you, they are the pits. Now, just looking over some of his stuff last night, do you know this guy, he wants to cut. Now, he's saying, oh, if I don't cut Social Security, he said, that's going to be, he said, if I don't cut Social Security, he said, we exempt that from any cuts. He said, then Medicare, Medicaid, and all other non-discretionary programs or non-defense programs will be cut at the same percentage point across the board. That means there will be, they will require 35% cuts in 2016 and 56% cuts in 2022. Now, without balancing the budget, the cuts will require smaller but still massive cuts, 28% in 2016 and 38% in 2022. Now, these are just – now, no one has asked him, what are you going to cut? Well, he's got no choice. If he's not going to cut Social Security, this is what's going to happen. He's got no choice. That's one thing that's going on. Another thing. And then we got this idiot, Ted Nugent. I mean, I don't even know what he's ever done. I don't care what he's ever done. All I know is that none of these people who have come out of their shells and out of hibernation, you heard from them, none of them. You heard from them when Bush was going into two different countries, creating two wars, when he had an $80 billion tax break for the ultra-rich, where he tanked the whole economy. You didn't hear a word out of these people. Nothing. They're making it all seem like none of this. Everything was just okie-dokie when Bush was in office. Well, it wasn't okie-dokie when Bush was in office. The Secret Service is having a little chat with Mr. Nugent today. It seems that he made, in case you didn't hear it, he made sort of a serious mistake by saying that if Obama was elected, he would either be dead or in jail. and that we need to go and chop their heads off. Well, you know, he wasn't chopping the head off Glenn Beck. We need to chop the heads off all these people who are running for office if they're not Tea Party people or Regressive Party people in some sort of a shape or form. He didn't say Tea Party or Tea Baggers or Regressive Party people, but he definitely wasn't talking about Democrats. And since they're the only two running, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure out what he meant. And it's just as bad saying something as not saying it and hinting. So the Secret Service will have a little talk with this mutt today. And then we have, which we're going to talk about later, the chairman of the North Carolina Democratic Party. Well, what I'm only going to say four words about that right now. He's got to go. Now, we will get back to him. That's another whole story in itself. And then we have this other mutt from Florida. You know, you get these people. Where in the world? These people just came. It was like, you know what it was like? It was like the inchworms and this infestation that we had this year in Mecklenburg County with the inchworms. I'm telling you, they didn't spray because they didn't have enough money, supposedly. I need to get somebody on to tell us why they didn't spray. Matter of fact, I think I will do that for next week. Why they didn't spray. It only sprayed in two counties, two areas in Mecklenburg. But if you had trees, and in certain trees, I mean, these inchworms were all over everything. I could not go out my driveway, and I would get in my car, and I would have 50 of them on me. My wife was going out of the driveway. She was dressed up like the secret monk. I mean, the hood on, long coat, forget it. And then they still would get on you. Then they would be in the car. And it was so funny, about 3 weeks ago, she left the sunroof open on her van, and she wouldn't get in the car. I had to go take the car out and get it clean and fumigate it. Oh, please. It was incredible. Anyway, this is like what's happening with these mutts in the Progressive Party. And the head mutt, this Alan West, I mean, this is the problem. Dale, I don't know how he became a colonel. Now, this is just, I need to read up something on this. Because how this mutt became a colonel, there can't be too many people. I just hope there are not too many people in the United States Army or the Marines or the Air Force that will go to the extent that this man is gone. I don't care about how he actually feels about the President of the United States. He can hate him all he wants. But when you are in the Congress, of the United States, there are certain rules that you should be governed by. You are there to represent your people. So in other words, that if the people he was representing him wanted him to be a terrorist, it would be all right for him to speak like this? Because this is what he's doing. He's a terrorist. He's a terrorist within our own country. He's now saying, and this wasn't today, this was a couple of weeks ago, he said there are between 78 and 81 communists, oh, by the way, they're all Democrats, in the House of Representatives. Now, the last time we heard this.
Does anybody know the last time we heard this?
Was in the 50s. From that Senator Joseph McCarthy. Now, here's some of the things that this moron has said. House Dems are communists. With Herman Cain and Sarah Palin standing behind him, this right-wing provocateur at a town hall meeting claimed there were 78 to 81 House Democrats were communists. Oh, but he didn't name any of them, okay? He said, I really wish that standing here before you was President Obama and not Alan West. We could have a simple, standing before you with President Obama. We could have a simple discussion, but it ain't ever going to happen. This is his words. When the audience member asked, why not? He replied in a mocking tone, because he was too scared. Okay, responding to the Congressional Progressive Caucus member, Representative Peter DeFazio pointed out that the last member of Congress to be accuse his colleagues of being communists was Representative Randy, I didn't take all the money, Duke Cunningham, who's now in prison for corruption. The second thing he said, congressional Dems should get the hell out. This is what he said. Speaking at Florida GOP dinner in January, he said, take your message of equality of achievement. You can take it to Europe. You can take it to the bottom of the sea. You can take it to the North Pole, but get the hell out of here, out of the United States. He said, I'm calling out Obama, Reid, and Pelosi by name. He said, tell them to stop destroying our country. Another one of his brilliant retorts said, the Nazis would be very proud of the Democrats. He said, if Joseph Goebbels was around, he'd be very proud of the Democratic Party, because they have the incredible propaganda machine, the National Jewish Democratic Council. The National Jewish Democratic Council asked West to apologize sincerely and immediately, while the Anti-Defamation League wrote a letter to the congressman saying his Holocaust analogies are offensive and trivialize the real historical events. Then he said, oh, they're only twisting my words. Another thing he said, Debbie Wasserman Schultz is not a lady. He's responding to a perceived affront from Wasserman Schultz during a House meeting. West called his colleague vile, unprofessional, despicable. You have proven repeatedly that you are not a lady, therefore shall not be afforded due respect from me. Let me go to another one. This is really good. This is what he said. Dems have called me Uncle Tom, a self-Oreo. A sell-out Oreo. Appearing on Fox News to defend his message to Wasserman Schultz, West tried to justify his remarks by saying that he had been the victim of a racial discrimination from Democrats. No, he is the victim of someone being born with half a brain. That's all. That's his problem. He said he also went on to say that we are not going to have our men become subservient. Speaking at a conservative women's conference in April, West lectured that liberal women have been neutering American men and bring us to the point of incredible weakness. So that means, he said, us to the point. I guess that means he's been neutered also. Well, normally when you neuter a male animal, they get more docile. So I guess he's one of the failures then. He also said women should raise Spartan men. Spartan men, strong men. The implication model example conservative women need to set. He boasted his reference with a not-so-subtle metaphor. We need you to come in and lock shields and strengthen up the men who are going to fight for you in the face of these Planned Parenthood women. Now, is he unaware of where he's at? Where over 90% of the regressive party members in the House never served a day in the military to defend this country. 70% of them who ran and ducked the draft, like their so-called man who's running for president now, Mitt Romney, who says, oh, I was doing God's work in France, just so coincidental during the whole time of his draft status. I guess we'll get back to that. Oh, and then he called Barack Hussein Obama a low-level socialist agitator. Now, here's the problem. This, we're going to have a show on this, what is a socialist, what is a communist. You know, you can't be a socialist and a communist at the same time. So if he's saying that Obama's a communist, he's not a socialist. Because never the twain shall meet. Then he said the biggest one of all. He said, I am here as a modern day Harriet Tubman. So I guess he's bisexual then. Of course, if he didn't remember, Harriet Tubman was a woman. He said, if West thinks he's often used historical references to strengthen his arguments. Apparently, Obama is the slave-driving leader of the 21st century plantation, wherein the Democratic Party has forever taken the black vote for granted. So where does West fit into his racial equation? I'm the modern-day Harriet Tubman, too kind of lead the people on the Underground Railroad away from the plantation and his masters. Oh, this guy. You know, this is. Oh, here's another one. Religious coexistence would give away our country. When West was campaigning to be the Tea Party candidate in Florida's 22nd district in 2010, he took aim at religious coexistence during a public referendum, slamming the popular coexistence bumper stickers, displaying the symbols of Christianity, Judaism, Islam, and the other religions. Those purple bumper stickers really pushed my buttons, and the reason why I get upset. And every time I see one of those bumper stickers, I look at the person inside that driving the car, because that person represents something that would give away our country. They would give it away. Who are they giving away my rights and my freedoms and my liberties? Naturally, this rant led into a verbal assault against Islam, which West often refers to as the American enemy. He also wants to, he said, we should be censoring American news agency. He now doesn't believe in freedom of press, only if it's the press that he wants to put out. He said, and the Tea Party, he compares it to the Blob. Alan West may be a Tea Party darling, but that hasn't stopped him from making occasional unflattering remarks about the movement. When you look at the Tea Party, he said, it's much like Steve McQueen's movie The Blob, he said on CNN in February. When asked about the movement's
failure to coalesce around one Republican candidate for president, he said, they're kind of different from each state to each state. There really is no central organization or structure to it. So each organization in its respective state, or even North Florida to South Florida, can differ. So in other words, he don't know what he's saying, because he probably never saw the movie The Blob. Someone probably told him that. Because he is a low information candidate. When he runs again, he's a low information candidate when he ran, and he's a low information representative, because he doesn't have to have a lot of major information, because he is talking to the people on Fox who are low information voters. Now, there are a few things that people keep talking about that this president has not done. This is what they say he hasn't done. And how much more can this man do? I just like to know how much more this man can do. Because, I'm going to give you a few samples of what this man has accomplished in his short time as being the President of the United States. One, he extended the child tax credits and marriage penalty the child tax credits and marriage penalty fixes. He increased the minority access to capital. He established the credit card bill of rights. He expanded the loan programs for small businesses. He extended the Bush tax cuts for lower income. Now, you got to remember, the Bush tax cuts also had a tag with it, where if he had cut those, a lot of these small businesses would not have gotten their loans. So there was a message in what he was doing when he did extend the tax cuts. He extended the tax cuts for all those making less than $250,000 as a couple, and $200,000 for a single person. He closed the donut hole with Medicare prescription drugs. He required insurance companies to cover pre-existing conditions. You could not get insurance if you had a pre-existing condition. What don't people get out of that? Of course, they'll only get it. Some of them will only get it when something happens. And believe me, as soon as something happens, if the Progressive Party gets in office, what will the Progressive Party say after they've gotten rid of Obamacare? They'll say, well, that was Obama's fault. That's what it's going to say. They twist everything. They give tax credits to those who needed help to pay health premiums. That didn't happen before. They required large employers to contribute to a national health plan. A lot of places did not contribute to your health plan when you work for them. They required children to have health care coverage. They expanded the state children's health insurance fund, CHIP, SCHIP. They required health plans to disclose how much of the premium was going to patient care, because every single time they raise your premiums, it's not because they're giving you more. It's because the board of directors wants to make more. They established an independent health institute to provide accurate and objective information. They keep saying, these Progressive Party members, oh, you don't want the government running your health care plan. Well, the government doesn't run it now. I had a daggone government health care plan. I still have it. I've never heard, not one time, from anybody that was in the government. These health care plans need to be reined in. We need to get rid of it and get a single payer. But you know, The president knew this couldn't be done. Not now. Not with a House where, even though he did have the majority when he first came in, but 50 to 60 of those people were blue door Democrats and would have never gone along with what the president wanted. See, you need to know how government works. And the short of it all is that when you have the most people in the Congress, you control all the budgets and everything that comes out of the Congress, out of the committees. If you don't control what comes out of the committees, you don't control any laws that may or may not be passed. So even though some of these laws might not get passed because there are a lot of blue dogs who are not going to vote with the president, the chairman of these committees are Democrats. So they will control what comes out of it. So the Republicans can't set the agenda. And that was the main thing that he had to get. Because if he didn't control that, we wouldn't have had half the stuff that I'm reading off to you right now. And people need to understand that. The president didn't do this and he didn't do that. No, he got other stuff done that he could get done. Because some of that other stuff, those 60 or so blue dogs would never have voted for. And it was more important to prevent their agenda from coming to pass than the president's agenda from coming to pass. And even if the president couldn't get all his agenda passed, he would block them. So this is a major problem that people need to understand about how government works. And let's go to our first caller here. Hello, who's this?
Bill Fison. How you doing, Michael?
Who's it? Didn't hear what he said. Who's this?
Bill Fison.
Bill Fison.
How are you doing?
How are you, Bill? I am doing fine. Okay. How are you?
I'm fine.
And?
Still here, Michael?
I am still here, Bill. I am still here. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Representative Bill Fison from the 50th House District. And, Bill, you are running for... What? Tell us what you're running for.
Governor.
You're running for the governor of the state of North Carolina.
That's right.
Is that correct?
That is right.
Bill, it was good seeing you the other day, and didn't have a chance to talk. Are you going to be at the Black Summit next week?
Of course.
Very good. Very good. So tell us, Bill, what do you want to do as if you become the next governor of this state?
Well, there's several things we got to deal with, Michael. As you know, North Carolina has a worse unemployment problem than every state in the union except for three. Not only that, we have 472,000 people who are out of work. The unemployment rate in this state is 10% unless you're African American. And then
right.
It's over 20%. And that doesn't include the folks who've given up looking or have taken part-time work. I talked to a woman just the other day who lost her $42,000 a year job 2 years ago. And she has done everything she could to find a job without success, has been working part-time, and just this month, finally found a job making $26,000 a year. She's taken a $16,000 a year cut in pay, and that is illustrative of the fact that it's now taking longer than any time in the last 60 years to find a job if you lose one. And if you can find one, on the average, you're taking a 17.5% cut in pay. Her cut in pay was even bigger. And so we need to get people back to work. I have a jobs plan. There are three pieces to it. If you'd like to see it, you can go to BillFason.com. That's BillFason.com. My jobs plan is there. My education plan is there, and my energy plan is there. You know, one of the things that these Republicans have tried to do is to gut the Racial Justice Act. The Racial Justice Act says that if you can show that the death penalty was imposed because of the color of your skin, then your sentence is changed to life in prison without the possibility of parole. Well, who could argue with the idea that nobody ought to be put to death because of the color of their skin? But I can tell you who'd argue with that. A bunch of daggum Republicans. Why, when we were getting that bill through, you know, Alma Adams and Larry Womble, representatives out of Winston-Salem, sponsored the bill in the House.
Right.
And we were getting it through my Ways and Means Committee. Every single Republican voted against it, every Democrat for it, and it passed. And then we got it to the floor of the House, and the same thing happened again. All those daggum Republicans voted against it, all the Democrats for it, and we got it passed.
Did they give a reason why they voted against it?
Some did, and the reason they gave was it wasn't needed, that it just would delay the amount of time it took to execute somebody, it would add additional cost to it. That the bill allowed somebody to use statistics to show that there was a pattern and practice of discrimination and that they were subject to that discrimination. In other words, they'd be able to show that the people in a particular county who got the death penalty, most of them were black, and be able to use statistics to show that and argue from the statistics that a disproportionate number of African Americans were getting the death penalty, and it wasn't fair. And
yeah, well, I guess there's something wrong. There's something wrong when you want to use statistics to back up your facts.
Especially when the whole daggum world runs on statistics. I mean, go to Apple and tell them they can't use statistics to figure out how to sell the next generation iPad and see what they say to you. I want you to go back to whatever planet you came from, wouldn't think you knew what you're talking about. And so, of course, statistics are valid. And the those were their arguments against it. They didn't want you to be able to use mathematical modeling to establish that there was a pattern and practice of racial discrimination. Now, most folks don't need a mathematical model to know that racial discrimination exists.
Yeah, you
still
think?
And it's a bad thing. So you don't have to have math to do it, but having math to prove it just puts in somebody's face in numbers what we all already know.
Yeah.
So anyway, the Republicans got in office, and they have tried gutting that bill. Of course, the governor vetoed it, bless her sweet soul. And I stand with the governor on that. And so they hadn't been able to override that veto, but old Pat McCrory has said the first thing he does if he gets elected governor is he's going to go in and override the Racial Justice Act and get that veto do away with it.
Well, that's why he lost Mecklenburg County when he ran for governor the last time.
Well,
and
he better lose it again this time. he better lose it again this time, otherwise we may all be in a deep pot of hot water. The other thing that he said he's going to override is the veto of the voter ID. You know, they passed the voter ID bill to try to make it more difficult to vote if you're African-American or older.
Right.
They're just trying to make you stay home. They don't want you voting. They're afraid you're not exercising your rights.
Well, you know, I got to tell you something. I went and early voted today. Now,
Now, Michael, let me ask you. Did you vote for me?
Hey, listen, what do you think?
I want to know, did you vote for me?
Hey, I can't tell you when I voted. It was a secret vote.
It may have been secret when you were in that ballot box, but you're out of there now. Did you vote for me, black man? Come on, tell me you did.
Hey, I can't tell you. I'll tell you when I see you Thursday or Friday.
Tell me on the air. Be bold. Be a man of your convictions. Step up to the plate. Hit that ball.
Not yet. I don't want to influence anybody's vote. Now, I got to be fair. As much as I don't want to be, I got to be. I got Bob coming on, and I got the Lieutenant Governor coming on now, and I can't do that now. That's not right.
You tell me when you see me.
I'll tell you when I see you. Absolutely.
All right.
Well, I know one thing. I voted for you for the state chair.
Well, that's good. You were right then. You'd be right now.
I voted for you, and I tell you what, I'm going to talk about that later, but that's another whole story in itself.
You were right when you did that one, and if you voted for me today, you were right a second time.
Now, hey, listen, I'm always right, so let's put it that way.
I know. You're a good man, Michael. You're a good man.
Now, let me tell you something else. Now, I went in and voted today. And I went down. They asked me my name. They asked me what address I was from. I had to sign a piece of paper to say who I was from. Now, I want to know. That's a criminal offense. If you sign your name to a piece of paper and you're not that person, that's a criminal offense.
Michael, I've only found 9 cases of voter fraud nationwide. 9 cases.
This is not a
problem.
That's right.
This is not a problem. This is about trying to make African Americans stay home and keep them from voting. This is a bad thing.
Well, yeah, but not just them, but the elderly and the youngsters. How many people we have in college that have a college ID which will no longer be correct to use?
I know. Those Republicans are bad people. They just are.
How do you propose to get, which is a big question. I try to take this in every single planning meeting I go for in the community and precincts to get people out to vote. They need to understand what the voting process is and how important it is. How can the governor, now, and I know this is very difficult, but what can the governor generate that will make people understand that when they don't vote, this is what happens, without having it happen first and then having them suffer?
Well, we've already got the track record of what these Republicans have done while they've been in there. We know they've tried to gut the Racial Justice Act. We know they've tried to suppress African-American and older voter with the Voter ID Act. We know they've gone after a woman's right to control her body with their legislation that told a doctor what he had to say to a woman and what she had to do before she could get health care. We know that they cut services to the community. They cut $1 billion out of Medicaid and SCHIP. We know they have fired teachers, teachers' aides, and other state employees. We know that when they did that firing, that they fired African-Americans and women disproportionately. We know they've done all that, Michael, and we know they've got more in mind. If that isn't enough to drive somebody out to protect themselves, their family, and their friends, I don't know what would be.
Well, you're absolutely correct. It is such a debacle. And there are two things that I really wanted to ask you about. What is the deal with this E-Verify bill?
What it is they are trying to keep anybody who is who has immigrated to this country from getting a job. And they are putting an additional burden on all businesses, requiring them to go to some federal site to get some form of verification before you can hire anybody. Now, if you got people who are your listeners, who are small business folks, they know the people they're hiring. They know who they want to hire. They know who they're going to work and who they're not going to work. They don't need to have any more government regulation put on them. They don't need to have any more costly government expenses added to what they're doing. But these daggum Republicans are all about their radical social agenda. They're not about helping people. They're about hurting people. They're about hurting people who are poor. They're about hurting folks' education. They cut out the Teachers Fellows Program, which provides scholarships for many a kid to become a teacher. They cut out over 6,000 needs-based scholarships that so many families depend on to help educate their children. They have done one bad thing after another.
The one other question I wanted to ask you is, I have been getting a lot of calls on this predatory lending bill. What can you tell us about this?
Well, I've taken a look at that bill. Did you know in that bill they allow an interest rates up to 36%?
Yes, I did. I looked it up yesterday. But,
isn't, awful,
but can't the banks? But can't the banks charge up to 37?
Well, I can go to 36 now, but it's on a lower amount of money they can do it on. And we need to protect people and protect people from banks and lending institutions that would do stuff like that. I mean, you just stop and do the math on that one. It isn't long before they get all your money. They give you a little money on the front end and just kill you on the back end. They stick you in a hole you can't climb out of. And what I'm trying to do is help with the economy and help create jobs, because I don't want people in a situation where they have to go do something like that.
Well, you know, well, one of the things that I was told, that the reason why they, some of these elected officials were for this, is because that you can't go to a bank and get a $1,000 loan, especially if you don't have any credit. The banks are not even going to loan you $1,000. So, I mean, if you don't want more than that, they're not even going to take care of you. So how would you help that person? See, because 37%, what I understand now, what they're saying, this 37% would just be 37%. But it would never go up any higher, or 36%. But with a bank, you could get, it could be 37% or even 25%, but then they're going to charge you for late fees, they're going to charge you for a whole host of other things, which might be, in essence, more than 37%.
Well, there's some community credit unions that have been doing a great job of making small loans.
Right.
There's one in Durham that's a great example of this, primarily serves the Hispanic community, but there's no reason they can't be put together to serve anybody and everybody. But the folks in Durham have been doing this very, very successfully, making small loans at reasonable rates.
Do we have any of these? Is Durham the only place that has it?
Only place I know of. There isn't any reason why there couldn't be one in Charlotte or Wilmington or Shelby or some other place, but as far as I know right now, the only one I'm aware of, now there may be others, it's just that the only one I'm aware of is in Durham.
Well, how would one start, if anybody's listening, how would one start to create a community bank like this?
I'd call the crowd in Durham and ask them how they did it.
Okay, that's good. That makes sense.
Also,
well,
Michael, there's some minority credit unions around the state. I don't know whether they amount to the same sort of lending institution, but that would also be another good place to go look and talk to, because the folks in the minority credit unions would already have the regulations in place, would already understand the banking side of it, and would have the infrastructure to impose on the distribution system and collection system.
Right. Right. Okay, so tie this up for us. How can they come out to help your campaign, and how can the people join the Face on Truth?
Go to BillFaison.com. That's BillFaison, BillFaison.com. And you can contact me there. You can contact people on my campaign committee. You can get bumper stickers. You can get signs if you want it. Whatever you want, whatever you'd like to do to help, if you'd like to organize to help at precincts or give out material or cards, you can get it all from that site.
All right. I will thank you, Bill Faison.
Thank you, buddy.
Who's our candidate for governor. Al's look forward to seeing you next week.
All right. Sounds good. I'm looking forward to it, too. Thank you for letting me visit with you today.
No problem.
Bye.
Bye-bye. That was Bill Faison, and we have another call. Let's see who is on this call here. Hello, who's this?
Hey, Michael, Bob Etheridge.
Bob Etheridge, how are you?
Well, I'm doing great. We're traveling down the road. We're on our way to Henson County.
You're on your way to Anson County. Well, are you going to see Vancine Sturdivant tonight?
Beg pardon?
Are you going to see Vancine Sturdivant tonight?
I hope so. I hope we see a lot of folks. We're on our way.
So, ladies and gentlemen, we have Bob Etheridge, who is running also for governor of the great state of North Carolina. And tell us a little bit about yourself, who, because we are being heard everywhere, even around the world. So tell us a little bit about yourself, Bob.
Well, Michael, I grew up in eastern North Carolina, son of tenant farmers. My mother nor my father had a high school education. And, you know, that's why I am so passionate about public education, because that's where the average youngster whose parents does not have a lot of resources has a chance to make it in this country. And they believe strongly in the public education system. And as I graduated from high school, I actually worked 2 years. We call them textile plants today. Then they call it a cotton mill, to save enough money to pay my first semester's tuition. And I was a walk-on on the basketball court. I ultimately won a scholarship, and that's how I paid for my education, by working on the weekends to have a little spending money. After spending 2 years in the United States Army, after that, I went to work in private business. And during my 19 years in private business, I served, got into public service because of education, served 4 years as county commissioners, 2 as chairman, 10 years in the North Carolina General Assembly. 4 of those years, I was chairman of the Appropriations Committee, and then was elected by the people of North Carolina to serve 8 years as the state superintendent of schools, where we did a lot of really neat things in terms of improving education, reducing dropout rates, putting in accountability, and then 14 years in the United States Congress, where I had leadership roles there doing a number of things. I think actually working with the president to get the recovery package passed over the opposition of every Republican in Congress, and in some cases some of my colleagues on our side of the aisle. And then we passed the Health Care Recovery Act that I voted for, and it was a close week and a heavy fight. And that, you know, it was the right thing to do, and I did it. I think it's going to make a difference in people's lives. For a person who had pre-existing conditions, they can now get health care. For those who have children who are under 26 years of age, they can be on their health care benefit. Generated a donut hole for seniors. Just a lot of things. You know, it was one of those things where it says you got to show leadership, you got to make the tough votes, you got to do the right thing, even if it costs you. And many people say it may have cost me my congressional seat, and that there it be, but you got to do the right thing. And when Governor Perdue decided she wouldn't run, I said, you know, what North Carolina now needs is someone who's had an opportunity to have executive experience and provide leadership, has legislative experience and knows how to do things and take on the tough chores of this state at a time when I think we're at a crossroads for two things: building a strong education foundation for the 21st century and attracting and building those 21st century jobs to keep North Carolina's momentum moving forward. That's a very quick thumbnail sketch of a
career. Well, we would need probably about 2 days for you to go through all your whole package. So
you're very kind.
Since we don't have 2 days, but you know,
no.
One thing I want to ask you: since you are you're just almost brand spanking new out of the Congress, tell us what you have seen, the difference, how the Congress has changed since when you first got in office to where you were just in.
It's become far more partisan, Michael. Same thing's happening at the state level. That is not really healthy in the long run for our democracy, because when you get big things done, I think at any level, I remember as a state legislator introducing the basic education plan to put thousands of teachers in North Carolina schools, reduce the class sizes, broaden the curriculum, put, you know, algebra as low as the seventh grade, all the things that made a difference and changed us in the early 90s, it really was pretty much bipartisan after we got it going. Same things usually happens in Washington. You know, bipartisan legislation, all the big things, the civil rights bill, was a bipartisan piece of legislation. But here in the last several years, it has become very partisan, and members tend to be campaigning, you know, on a two-year cycle, you start all over again. That is not a long-term healthy sign, I think, for democracy. So let's hope this is a phase we're going through and we'll work out of it.
Well, you know, the when we go back to this is not the Republican Party. Like, I don't call them the Republican Party anymore. They're the regressive party now. The Republican Party were the Bob Michaels and the Bob Doles and the,
sure,
the Jack Kemps, who you could do business with, because this is a representative republic. We're not a democracy, like everybody says. We're a representative republic, and because
Absolutely.
We are a representative republic, we have to bargain when you're up there. The whole thing is to get something done, not to get nothing done.
Oh, I couldn't
and
agree more.
And
agree
the thing
really
is
what it's about.
Right.
Well, we've got folks who say it's either my way or the highway. I won't
right.
negotiate. It's happening in Washington. We're now seeing it. They have taken that template that really started with Newt Gingrich and carried it
right.
down to the state levels. And I think one of the real damaging things, and I hope I'm wrong, but I think it's starting to rear its ugly head, is all this heavy negative advertising paid for when the Citizens United case was brought, and now you got large corporate and wealthy people are putting themselves in the position to buy government at every level.
Well, you know,
the thing is that
since the Citizens United came forward, you've heard less and less of the Tea Party than we did before, because they're irrelevant now, because they don't
of
need
course.
A Tea Party, because they can buy their way.
That's right.
You know?
No, but that's why I'm running for governor. I think this may be the last time a guy who comes from meager beginnings can have a chance to run for governor because of the structure we have now and make a difference for the average child who wants to go to school, who wants to go to college. Do you realize in the last 10 years in North Carolina, tuition and fees at our public universities have doubled in 10 years?
Oh, yes. Yeah, because I'm paying some of it right now for my daughter.
Yeah, and so, but think about those families who come from less than stellar opportunities.
Right.
Who are the first in their family who want to go to college, like I was, they're going to have a hard time coming out with huge debts, choosing vocations
Absolutely.
To be teachers and social workers and police officers and firemen, those jobs that we really need in this country.
Well, what do you think on the education level? Because I'm from New York City, and when I grew up, I went to high school. I was on it. I went to a school that had a three-track course. We had those that wanted to go to college took an academic course. Those that wanted to be in the commercial business, accounting and things like that, took a commercial course. And those that wanted to be in the mechanics and the wooden the wood makers and the tool makers took a vocational course. To me,
sure.
we need to go back to that, because everybody is not going to be Albert Einstein and everybody is not going to be a CPA.
Let me give you a little twist on that, Michael, because I think we do need the vocational emphasis. I took vocational courses when I came through. But what you also have to have, and I hope you'll agree with this, you got to have a strong foundation of the basics, reading,
oh,
writing, math, technology today. Then choose some of the others. Because even if you decide to go to the university and become whatever you want to become, or if you want to go to community college, there are going to be a day when you're going to need to change, you know, do a little plumbing. You know, things
right.
mess up.
Absolutely.
You need a little help. You may need to
Absolutely.
Do a little electrical. A lot of little things you want to do. Those vocational courses are helpful to everyone, even to include women, because there are times when you may want to, I hope you don't, it's not as much today as it used to be, you may want to need to change the tire on your car if you get stranded somewhere. You need to know how to do these things.
Listen, I want to tell you something. My youngest daughter called me up about a about 15 minutes before the show started today, and she wanted me to come out and put air in her tire. I said, are you kidding me? I'm going to put air in your tire? She said, yeah, but I might put too much in. I said, it's not a balloon. I mean, so right now, I think she just didn't want to get her hands dirty. That's the problem. But you're absolutely true, because you may need to be able to do something around the house. Absolutely.
Sure. And, you know, I am so pleased to see our sons. We have two sons, and they have little folks now, have babies. But they're so good at helping change diapers and do that thing, where sometimes we men didn't do it years ago. Hey, they're getting into it. I think that's very good for our society. It's healthy for everybody.
Absolutely, without a doubt. But what is your platform consist of that you want to try to get done if you had the house on your side?
Well, I think there's several things we got to do in North Carolina. We got to literally rebuild, or we don't have to rebuild. We have to re-engage in quality education in our state, pre-kindergarten, community colleges, and universities. North Carolina has a premier university system, a great community college system, and we're now, the Children's Assembly is starving all three of them, and I think if we don't get refocused and fund education first and honor our teachers and make sure that they feel like they're the quality people we know they are, doing marvelous things in the classroom, performing magic every day, and respect them, we're going to be in trouble in the future. I think that's got to be first. That then will lead to the dynamics that we have to create those quality jobs in the 21st century, now and down the road, because in North Carolina, that's how we wound up with the Research Triangle Park. That's how we wound up with the metro area in Charlotte. And across our states and around our dynamic universities, that's got to be done all over again. You know, every generation has to regenerate those things. We're at a point now where we've got to do it all over again and make sure none of our students miss that opportunity to be that quiet genius that they can be. They may not be an Einstein, but they sure can be wonderful, creative people if we give them an opportunity to do it.
Absolutely. And I have to ask you, because I just before you came on, I had the Bill Faison on, and I've been getting blasted with this call, people calling me about House Bill 810, the predatory Loan Act. What's your position on that, or what do you think about that?
Well, you know, it's amazing how people want to prey on folks that have so little and wind up jacking up the interest rates. Then they wind up losing everything they've got in some cases.
Mm-hmm.
I thought we had gotten that settled, and now they want to revisit it all over again. North Carolina was a leader in stopping predatory lending.
Okay. Mm-hmm. That's right. Well, you know, one of the things that some of the people are saying, well, we need this because some of these people out here now have lost everything. They don't have any credit at all, and they might need $1,000 to hold them over to pay a mortgage, but they can't do it because they can't even borrow $1,000 from a bank. Bank's not going to loan you $1,000.
Well,
so, I mean, what do you say to someone like that?
Well, I think what to do, I know when I was in the General Assembly, it's been a few years since I served there, we helped at the state level put money in to start community credit unions, and there are ways we ought to do that. That's how you help folks who don't have a stellar credit record. But those community banks are really good at that, and they really help folks. Because once you start that, then they get into good habits, and all of a sudden you wind up, you really help them rather than put them back in the ditch.
Right.
I think funding community credit unions is a lot better way to do it. Now, in every community, that may not work as well as it should, but that's the best way to do it, in my view. Because otherwise, if I'm coming in and buying something, it's 30 to 40%. Man, I'm on a bicycle. Mm-hmm. I'll never get to the top of the hill. The truth?
Yes, you're absolutely correct. I agree with you there. I wanted to know there is how what can we do to help our veterans in this state. And so many of them, I'm hearing now, are on food stamps. The heck can we have veterans on food stamps? I mean, as a veteran myself, I'm a Vietnam War vet, and I want to tell you, it is a disgrace, especially when 75% of the Progressive Party that's in the House right now never served a day in the Army. As a matter of fact, they were cowards and ran. So, I mean, I don't understand this. Well, why can't we help our people who, some of them have paid the ultimate price, some of them have paid almost the ultimate price. I mean, we need to help these people.
Michael, I served as you did in the Vietnam era.
Yes.
And we should never, I'll say this about those men and women who served, we should never in America again have people treated the way our soldiers were when you and I served.
Absolutely.
I mean, you remember that you couldn't wear your uniforms at home, you know, when you put in civilian clothes because people looked at you the way they did. But be that as it may, we passed, as you remember, the new GI Bill of Rights that just kicked in last year before I left Washington. And now we're saying, and we changed it one more time, saying it was modeled after World War II. The old Montgomery GI Bill of Rights didn't fully pay for going on to school. This one does. And we also said if you've already gotten your college degree and you have a child that wants to go, that child can use that. I think that's a good move. The thing we have to do now is we have to be in a position not to forget the sacrifice they've made and take away their health care benefits and other benefits they need because of the men and women who served in Iraq and Afghanistan, the Guard, Reserve, as well as our active military. Many of those people are coming home with somewhere in the neighborhood of 25% to 30%+ of PTSD or brain trauma. That is going to be a long-term cost that we have to meet. Now, beyond that, for those who are looking jobs, we have to re-engage, step up the state and federal activities to make sure they get better preference for whatever job may be available in the public sector, and then reach out and do partnerships with the private sector and encourage them to do the same thing.
Well, you know, now how much of a influence does, because I understand now, because my wife works at the VA, and she works right here in Charlotte, and I understand they're opening up a new hospital here. I don't know. She said she thought she might know where it's going to be at. But how much, what sort of say does the governor have in the VA hospital when it opens up of what's going to go on?
That's federal, not state. The governor would not.
Okay, so there would, so realistically.
Other than being supportive. That's really a federal decision, yeah.
Okay, but so monies, there is a lot of monies that come in. I don't know how much money. That's one thing we need to know. How much money comes into the state from the federal government to support?
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
It's in the billions. See, we have three major military bases in North Carolina. Fort Bragg, as an example, is probably somewhere to well in excess of $10 billion. You got Lejeune, Cherry Point, and Seymour Johnson. All of those are major installations that provide a lot of benefit to our national security, first, and to our state, second, and to our communities, big time. You have a lot of talented people in those communities, and many of them stay here and retire and like to call North Carolina home. We really need to utilize those retirees more and more because there's a lot of talent that could help North Carolina as we start to move, to generate jobs, and expand into the 21st century.
If you become governor now, when when there is a major, hurricane or a disaster that occurs, the proper steps are for the, the FEMA to come to speak.
Yes.
FEMA to come speak to you first, correct?
Yes.
They ask you if you need help, or do you go to FEMA? How does that work?
well, the way it works, if you have a natural disaster, FEMA always immediately ties into the state emergency management. And we do have an outstanding one in our state. They are the, their job is to be pre-positioned for a storm. Now, that's for hurricanes. Tornadoes, you don't get to be pre-positioned for those because they just happen. But you pre-position, and then as they hit, they station material to bring it in, to bring people in. One of the real challenges I think we need to work on as a state, and probably other states do too, but really here because we get hit so much, after the storm leaves, FEMA's there for a period of time, then they leave. We have to do, we're doing a fair job. We need to really work and have a long-range strategic plan for working with the faith community because you got the Baptist men, you got the Methodists, you got the Catholic charities, you got the Lutheran, you've got any number of faith groups that come in to work with families and communities as the federal government moves out. And to some extent, because they're helping people whose insurance didn't cover the full cost or a host of other things. So I'd like to see us really work in that area. And I saw that when the governor asked me to go down east and do some work after this last hurricane. And I saw very readily because the hurricane hit North Carolina, then it went up the East Coast. And a lot of these faith groups sort of moved on up the coast. And we didn't have enough resources to do some of the things we needed to do. And I think that's one of those areas we can really pay some attention to that in the long run will be very beneficial for our folks.
Well, I noticed that you have a lot of interest in education. And I think we're ranked now 49th, and we were like 5th or 7th in the country. I mean, this is a space of 2 years we went to decline like this. I mean, if you became the governor and you didn't get a change in the turnover and it remained the same as it is, how can you help us get back some of the things that we have lost in this state without having a Democratic House?
Well, I hope the people in this state would help change the House and the Senate, but what you've got to do is work with what you got. What I did in Washington when I was a member of Congress, I introduced a bill called the Hometown Heroes Bill. I got a letter from a constituent that said, I'm tired of filing these reports to the federal government for firemen or law enforcement who lose their life of a heart attack or stroke within 24 hours of coming off duty. Because 42% of all the firemen who lose their lives lose it of a heart attack or stroke within 24 hours of coming off duty. Stressful job, get a lot of heat. Anyway, I introduced the bill. It took me 3 years to get it passed. We had a Republican House, we had a Republican Senate, and a Republican president named George Bush. We organized through associations every firehouse in America, all of our police and sheriff's departments and first responders. We put enough pressure on every single member of Congress and the speaker. They put that sucker out. They were sure they weren't going to pass it, but they put it on the floor. We passed it. We got through the Senate. The president signed it. I think what you do to answer your question is, if the General Assembly does move, you go across the state, you organize the business community, you organize parents, you organize those groups who are interested in the future of this state. That means that's everybody, if you explain it to them. And I'm telling you, we can make them move whether they want to or not. I believe that.
Well, that is a great, as a matter of fact, it's almost inspirational that we can, that can actually come to pass, that there wouldn't be, because it just seems to me that since the president, Barack Obama, became president of the United States, he has gone to so many Republican ideas, and soon as he said he was for it, they were now against it.
Oh, they did it with health care. Hello. Listen, the bill that we passed that I voted for, to help pass it, it was a close vote. I mean, we fought every step of the way. It was a bill that they wanted, that the Heritage Foundation supported. And then as soon as we got it introduced, they were against it. Listen, that's good for America. Listen, every president since Teddy Roosevelt, Democrat and Republican, has said we needed health care, except George Bush.
Yeah. Right. Absolutely. Well, you know, the thing is that I'd like you to give us a tie-up into why we need to come out and vote for you, for governor of North Carolina.
I'd be honored to, and I thank you for letting me do it. Because I told someone the other night, there's a lot of issues. People can talk about a lot of things. But at the end of the day, what do you want in the governor's leadership? Someone who can lead, who has led. I've done it as an executive when I was superintendent of schools. I was in business myself for 19 years, running three different businesses, two of them at one time, and being in the General Assembly. I've had legislative experience in Washington and in Raleigh. And I can, you know, work across party lines when I need to, but what I can really do is when you have to do it, I've stood up, made the tough votes, made the tough decisions to get things done. And that's what it's about. Who can get things done? I can do that. And you've got to be able to have someone who can stand on their feet and go toe-to-toe with whomever it is, if you have to do it, and move North Carolina forward. It is about leadership. But equally important, it's about someone who understands that every county in North Carolina is different. You know, what's good for Charlotte, what's good for Wake County may not be good for Northampton County or Gates, and we have to put together a plan for jobs for all 100 counties, and they have to be partners in it and pull it together. I can do it, and I would encourage folks to go vote early for Bob Etheridge. Vote on May 8th, or go to our website, BobEtheridgeForGovernor.com, and figure out how you can help, be involved, be engaged. This may be the most important election, certainly in the last 20 years.
Well, in the last 20 years, you know, and if we don't straighten out the problem we have right now,
it could be in a lifetime.
It would be in a lifetime. You're absolutely correct.
We got to fix it. That's why I'm running
thank
for
you.
Governor.
I want to thank you so much.
You.
And I want to thank you for your service to this country in the Army
too.
and in the House.
Thank you, my friend.
It's been my pleasure. Are you going to be up at the at Raleigh next week at the Black Summit?
I think the answer to that is yes.
Okay.
I haven't looked at the schedule, but I'm pretty sure that's correct.
Okay. I look forward to seeing you.
Okay. Thank you, Michael. Bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye. And that was our the representative from the 2nd Congressional District. He used to be Bob Etheridge, who is running for governor of North Carolina. Now, we have a lot of people who have really had a major problem with what is going on in this state. I mean, there are a lot of people that have a major problem with what is going on in this state. We had, let me see if I can close this out here. I don't know what's going on. If the call is not going through, so we have to see. We have the chairman of the state of North Carolina Democratic Party had a press conference today. I got a phone ringing in the background. And he said that he is not going to resign until the state executive committee meets. Well, I have a major problem with that, because the chair of this party may be the chair who was elected. He may be the person that people want in the office. But he's not a king, and he is definitely not a deity. And if the state council, the governor, the auditor, state secretary of state ask you to go, you need to go gracefully and swiftly. This has been a distraction beyond what is needed here in this state. We do not need this distraction. We do not need this distraction. We need to have people who are involved in this party, who want to be involved in this party, who do not want any other distractions, because we have young people who have been involved in this party for such a long time that it is now it is not even close to an idea. We had people who have put their heart and soul into the party, only to have it come to a conclusion like it is right now. And let me see who's on hold here. Hello.
Hello.
Hello. Yes.
Hello.
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Speaking to? Yes, I hear you fine.
This is Linda Coleman.
Linda Coleman, how are you? Running as a candidate for lieutenant governor in the state of North Carolina.
That's correct.
Linda, I was a hung up. The phone was hung up here, and I couldn't get over to you, but I finally did.
Well,
so, Linda Coleman,
I want
you to introduce yourself to the many people that are listening to you, who may not have heard of you, and I don't know why, since you have done almost everything around. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Absolutely. My name is Linda Coleman, of course. I'm a candidate for lieutenant governor. I was born and raised in eastern North Carolina, Greenville to be exact. I graduated from North Carolina A&T State University in Greensboro. Graduated from the University of Pittsburgh's Graduate School of Public and International Affairs with a master's degree in public administration. I have been a classroom teacher, and I have served the state of North Carolina in many capacities. I have served as an HR manager for the Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services, for the Department of Administration, for the Community College System. I've served as the Wake County Commissioner and as chair of the Board of Commissioners. I was elected 3 terms to the North Carolina General Assembly, House of Representatives. I was appointed by the governor to serve as the state personnel director. So in a nutshell, that is my career history. And I resigned my position as the state personnel director just a couple of weeks ago so that I could devote full time to running for the position of lieutenant governor.
Well, since I ran out of space on my paper, all the things you have done, is there anything else I can turn the paper over on the back?
No, I think that's about it. And
that's about it?
I certainly have served my community. I really belong to a lot of civic organizations, community organizations. I'm a deacon in my church. Really just enjoy public service. It was what I was born to do, and I have a passion and a commitment to public service.
Why do you want to run for lieutenant governor?
because I believe that I've got the background and the experience to bring jobs to our state, to help our state recover from this recession. I know that I have the relationships, the experience, the background that will really allow me to make a difference in the in bringing back the jobs to this state.
It's a simple question, but I've asked it of a lot of people, and you'd be surprised how many people can't give you an answer. What does the lieutenant governor do?
Well, actually, I would say the biggest thing that the lieutenant governor does is, number one, it presides over the Senate. Two, by virtue of the position itself, it serves on the State Board of Education as well as on the State Board of Community Colleges. And, of course, having been a classroom teacher and having worked in the community college system and currently serving on the Wake Tech Board of Community Colleges, I certainly understand the relationship there. And actually, that background itself provides me with the perfect opportunity to accomplish the goals that I would set forth as lieutenant governor in terms of bringing jobs back to the state.
So your main, I guess, interest would be the education system, because I understand, I was just talking to Bob Ethers about this, that I think we went from fifth or seventh in the country now to 49th in monies funding our education system, because I think the Regressive Party always says, we don't need money to fund the education system, because that will only help other people. But what do we need to bring us back to where we were?
Well, there isn't just one thing, and I would say that we would need a combination, and I think that combination is just what I would bring to the lieutenant governor's position for economic recovery, and it would be a three-legged stool. One would be jobs in the economy, focusing on that as the central part. Education from pre-K through the university system, and of course, workforce training. And when you put all three of those together, that would certainly make for a winning, successful success, I believe, in making that accomplishment. I think that what we have to do is to look at where our economy is now and to understand that there are jobs out here, but we simply don't have the skills to fill those jobs, the skill set. And what we need to do is to have a conversation between businesses and the educational institutions to look at what the skill sets are and to make sure that we are providing the training that will bring those skill sets so that we can employ people, because you cannot attract jobs to this state if you don't have a trained workforce. And so what we need to do is to go ahead and train the workforce right now. We can do that by looking at the future. I know that we need jobs right now, and to do the jobs right now, we need to make sure that we put our people in a position that they can go to a community college, get the education that they need, the skill set that they need, and be prepared to join the workforce. For the future, we need to look at emerging markets. We need to look at what the trends are in terms of healthcare, biotech, energy, the green economy. There are so many emerging economies out there. What do we want to focus on? And to go ahead and start talking to the business community right now and asking our business community to join the community college in their areas to look at how they can start preparing the workforce, what those skills need to be so that they can go ahead and get them in the curriculum so that our people can get trained and be ready for the workforce when it comes. There also needs to be more communication among several entities. I don't think that we need to just involve the the community colleges and the businesses, but we need to also bring to the table everybody who has a stake, and that would be our financial institutions, our educational institutions, our businesses, our government people. We need to bring everybody to the table to figure out what role they each will have to play. We need to figure out the infrastructure that's needed for some of these new jobs. And if, in fact, there needs to be legislation or whatever so that when it's time to recruit these, we have what we need, or we can start planning for what we need 5 years down the road, 7 years down the road. That's going to help our recruitment process.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I was talking to a friend of mine and who's going to be on the show in a little while, and he was telling me how the education system is so deeply underwhelming that where he's at, some green companies were going to come and bring different plants down there, but they're bringing their own people because the people where they're going to bring the plant, they can't hire because they're not educated enough.
That's exactly right, and that is my point. That is why that's one of the reasons our state has increased its population. And that's not to take away from the quality of life that our state offers, because it does offer a wonderful quality of life. And we've got some great things here. We've got one of the best university systems in the country, public university systems in the country. We also have one of the best community college systems in the country. But I will tell you that when companies come, if they don't have the skills, they have to bring them with them. And so that's adding to the population here. So what we're saying is we can have everything you need. Just let us know. And that brings in another point, because I would like to see the way we recruit change. We have a very diverse state here. It is a beautiful state. We have the mountains, the Piedmont, the Triad, the Triangle, the Coastal Plain, and the coast. And each one of the regions of North Carolina has something unique about it. Just like we look at Charlotte as hosting the banking industry, we look at the Triangle, the Research Triangle Park as hosting research and development industry, why can't we research and figure out what would be the best industries to recruit to each region and start it that way so that we don't look at just recruiting companies but recruiting industries? And I think that would help us tremendously. But again, we need to bring all of the stakeholders to the table to look at this, to figure out a plan on a recruitment plan, and not just going out here recruiting haphazardly, saying, you know, we want to bring this here, we want to bring that here, but looking at where the fit is going to be, where the skill sets are going to be, what the community colleges want to offer, because they can do all kinds of training. They just need to know what the needs are. They can fulfill the needs. That's why, and we need more articulation or communication among our public school system, our community colleges, and our universities, because they each have a very different role, but their roles are relative to each other as well. And so we need to look at them as a whole and not always as a separate entity, but how they feed into one another.
Right. Well, I would like you, it is very refreshing to hear this from someone who has such understanding about how the education system needs to work and should work. And so you would bring these skill sets to the table. And since you're involved with many of the boards, the college boards, I think this would be a great you could have a great influence on how this is shaped in North Carolina.
Absolutely, because one of the things that I will tell you, Michael, is that you cannot. I have been in several elected offices, and I can tell you that you don't do anything by yourself. you have in the General Assembly, for instance, in the House, you've got to convince 60 other people to buy into your idea. I don't care how bright you are, how many great ideas you have, you've got to convince 60 other people before it becomes a law. And so so much of it is based and built on relationships. That's
how
things get done. And through the years, through my work with community organizations, government officials, and others, I have built these relationships. I know these people. We have mutual respect for one another, and that builds the collaboration that you need to get things done. So using your relationships is a big part of accomplishing an agenda. You can have an agenda, but if you go there thinking that this is what I'm going to do and you know nobody, then you're going to take your agenda and you're going to be there all of that term just with you and your agenda.
Right. Well, I'd like to I want you to tie up why we need to have you as our next Lieutenant Governor.
You need to have me. The state of North Carolina needs me as the next Lieutenant Governor because what my past experience, my background, my passion, and my commitment to public service have all prepared me perfectly for the position of Lieutenant Governor. My experience with the community college system, state personnel director, manager in state government, elected office, this is the perfect position to help move North Carolina forward. And that's what I am counting on because we are a progressive state, but we have regressed in this last year. And I love this state, and I don't want to see us to continue to go back. I wanted to see us to continue to move forward. And the way to do that, of course, is through our education system. It is through the high-skilled jobs that we want to have in North Carolina. So those are the kinds of things that I would bring to this role. I already have them. There would be no learning curve for me. I've been around these people for years. I know them, and I have a relationship with them, and I can get some things done.
Well, I want to thank you, Linda Coleman, and we are going to hear from you again. Are you going to be up at the maybe at the Black Summit next week?
I will be.
Well, then I will see you there because I'm going to be doing a live show from there.
Okay.
I will see you up there also.
Okay.
And I want to thank you for being on the show today, and sorry for that glitch and having you hold. I just want to just forgive me for that glitch. I will see you next week.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
That was Linda Coleman, who is running for Lieutenant Governor in our great state of North Carolina. And we have two people on hold right now who have been waiting a little while. Let's see if I can get them both on at the same time. Hello there. Who do I have?
John Brooks, congressional candidate in San Diego, California, 51st District.
Ah, and who is the other gentleman, if I didn't know?
This is Christian Schneider. Political consultant
for who or whom?
For John
moment.
Brooks,
for
congressional candidate in the 51st District of California.
I want to thank you guys for calling in from the left coast, as we say here.
Thanks for having me.
Mr. Brooks, well, I just wait. Since you've been there the longest, I want to ask you to just explain who you are so everybody here in North Carolina can understand who you are and what you're trying to do.
Well, greetings to the people of North Carolina. John Brooks is my name. I'm a congressional candidate for the 51st District in California, which encompasses San Diego and Imperial County. I was a federal government employee for 30 years, 26 in law enforcement. I'm from Oakland, California. I grew up in Oakland and Los Angeles. I went to college in Missoula, Montana, of all places, to follow my dream of getting a degree in wildlife biology, and I became the first Black American to actually graduate from that program at that school. And then I went on to a, like I said, a 26-year career in law enforcement. After a 3-year career in biology, I was one of the first 15 Black agents for the Department of Interior of the United States Fish and Wildlife Service. And now I seek to be, to my great surprise, the first American of African descent to become a congressman in San Diego. And there's never been one here before.
Oh, that is unbelievable. And what is the... why? But why hasn't there been one there before?
Well, that's
what
a good question. I would have to attribute it to the system and the fact that most Americans are dropping out of their civic duties, and there's a great disparity where people, minority people, feel that they have no say-so in the political process.
Mm-hmm.
So we're being pushed out.
And now, Mr. Christian Snyder, who I have known for a little while, why have you chosen Mr. Brooks to try to help get this seat?
You know, John, I believe, is the best candidate in this race. You know, we've had basically the same leadership for the last 15, 20 years on the state and local level, which are both of his opponents, and yet the same issues face the community. You know, unemployment, El Centro has the highest unemployment rate in the country. It's over 28% right
now.
El
Centro is the name of it, right?
Right, and it's in Imperial County. Imperial County, you know, as a county, has the largest unemployment rate in the country. It's over 28%. It cyclically hits over 33% every single year for the past 15 years, and that was a big drop down.
So this was even during the Bush administration, when all the millionaires and billionaires were getting their tax breaks, it didn't trickle down to them.
Absolutely. And, you know, this area is where two-thirds of the vegetables during the winter months are eaten by our nation. I mean, it's a major, major agricultural center for the United States. And billions of dollars are about to be poured into this area for green technology projects. And yet still, the unemployment rate is staggering. And a lot of that has to do with education. You know, and certain districts...
We were just talking about that. We were just talking about that.
Yeah. And it's there's a real disparity between Latino and African-American students and low-income students, where in some schools you're seeing only 15% are actually going to college, and that number then drops again to only 10% are able to get through the first year once they get to college. You know,
so is this a reasoning because of the pre-K, no pre-K, not starting off on the right foot? I mean, what's the reason?
I think it encompasses all those problems. I think it's a systematic leadership failure where they haven't really prioritized these children. You know, when I say that Latino, African American, low income, English language learner students, those normally are minority students in a district. That comprises over 85% of the school district in the 51st congressional. So this isn't like, hey, we're just failing a few kids. We're failing a majority of the children. And it's why the economy is so difficult down here. And it's why unemployment is so high, not only in Imperial County, but in South San Diego as well. These children are never even given a chance.
Well, why isn't the – we have a Democratic governor there. Well, why hasn't something been done about the what's going on down in the bottom portion of San Diego?
Well, they say that there's no money. You know, I continuously hear, oh, well, you know, California's in debt and da-da-da-da-da. As a matter of fact, they're going to be cutting even more funds from these kids. These are the kids that are slated to cut funds from. And I believe that, you know, they're targeted because they don't have a voice. Mm. You know, who is out there speaking for low-income children and ELL students? Everyone always tends to think, ah, they're just the minority, you know. Mm. And the community isn't empowered enough to really stand up and say, hey, no, we're not going to cut this. Go tax one of these companies. Have one of these companies pay their fair share of taxes before you consider cutting education again.
Well, Mr. Brooks, I when you told me about working for Fish and Wildlife, it reminds me of the film the Freshman, where the Fish and Wildlife with Marlon Brando and Matthew Broderick. But the thing is, why did you decide that this is the place you want to hang your hat and help?
You mean the 51st Congressional District?
Yes, right.
Well, I retired in 2008, making San Diego my home. And I'm currently a writer. I write books for children to educate them on environmental issues and just life issues. And I'm also a musician. But my life is pretty good. But when this movement of discontent happened, it allowed me to take a look at what was occurring to other people in the community and how they weren't given a fair shake and how they weren't ever going to have the benefits that I'm receiving from the federal government. And that disturbed me. Being the only candidate who has worked this entire district, the other two have legislated. There's actually seven people in this race. But I'm the only one who has worked the district, been on the streets with the average person, understands what they're going through. It just felt natural for me to seek this seat, which actually is an open seat as well. The current representative, Bob Filner, is running for mayor of San Diego now. And many of the people I've spoken with in the district would like me to continue his legacy. He's well known for his civil rights legacy, his stand on veterans, and those are all big issues on my platform.
Well, you see, now, is he African-American?
Actually, he's Jewish.
Oh, he is. Okay.
He marched with Reverend King during the Civil Rights Movement and was in the Montgomery bus boycott and all that. So he understands what we go through.
Well, now, one of the things that I'm trying to put you, because everybody, every time you see a picture of San Diego, it's so beautiful, and everybody's riding bicycles, and everybody's having a good time, everybody's eating, but you're painting a whole new scenario in my mind about what's going on in San Diego. This is part of San Diego.
Well, perception is 90% of the truth, isn't it? That's what the people who want to take your tourist dollars want you to believe, and they will not steer you to the areas in the 51st District. As an example, there's a community called City Heights within the district, and it is actually the most diverse community in the United States. You have African Americans, you have African immigrants, you have Vietnamese, China, everything is right there. It could actually be the model community of the United States, and yet is treated as a blithe community where people should be afraid to go. In fact, when I was walking the district, shaking hands, introducing myself to people, many times a person would say, wow, you're running for Congress and you're walking this street? You know, they're shocked. I'm there.
Even the people that live there?
Well, let me back up. They weren't saying it because it's dangerous. They were saying it because they have never seen a politician walk their streets because the perception is this is a dangerous area. And there are people just like us that want a shake. They want a fair shake. They want to be employed. They want to be educated. They want to live healthy, prosperous lives just like the rest of us.
Well, how come they don't get involved in the party? Is there a party down there? Where is the Democratic Party at?
They're here, but apparently they're not talking or reaching out to this community. And one of the things I actually want to do is rebuild civic duty in the community so people know that they do have a stake, their vote does count, and they can make a difference, and they should actually get involved with the process. As Christian was saying, they're being neglected because they're not being spoken for.
Well, what's the voting populace like? I mean, how many people come out and vote?
Christian?
Do they have precincts?
Well, in the African American community, it's the current voting age population is slightly over 10%. You know, it's mainly a Latino district, but there are a lot of other areas that have been neglected because of the primary system. California has now instituted what are called open primaries, where the top two vote getters, regardless of party, move on to the general election in November.
Oh, you mean to tell me they have Republicans running with Democrats?
Absolutely. So Republicans can vote for Democrats. Democrats can vote for Republicans. You know, you could have two Republicans go forward. You could have two Democrats go forward. Party affiliation is not supposed to play any role in the elections any longer.
I mean, this is who the heck is running the Democratic Party? Now, that doesn't take place in the entire state.
It does. It was a voter-approved referendum 2 years ago where they asked.
In Los Angeles, you mean in Los Angeles, Republican can run in the same election with a Democrat?
Yeah, so it doesn't affect city and countywide races. Where it affects is your statewide or your district-wide, so assembly races, state races, and federal races. But a lot of cities already have an open primary system of some sort. Like San Diego, for instance, does have an open primary system. So right now the top candidates in the San Diego mayoral race is one Democrat and three Republicans.
Jesus.
It's supposed to properly reflect the district. So this is a heavily Democratic district.
Right.
So if it was a Republican versus a Democrat, you know, the Democrat's just going to win. It's a very safe Democratic seat. So in order to give more selection, because a lot of the state is like this, they're saying, hey, you know what? You have a choice between two Democrats in the general election.
Unbelievable. Tell us, Mr. Brooks, what is your main topic or bullet points that you want to get across to the listening audience and get across to the people in El Centro?
Well, the top one would have to be that the education system is failing our community. As Christian stated, it's an obvious disparity on what's happening, the achievement gap between Americans of African descent, immigrants, English speakers, versus the rest of the population is staggering. And until we fix that and bring up people up to par where education becomes a great equalizer, we're still going to have systemic unemployment rate, kids not going to college, not achieving their full potential. There's probably a kid out there right now in El Centro that holds the key to the new transportation system of the future, but because he or she doesn't have the wherewithal to go to school or reach their full potential, we're never going to know that. So we definitely have to change that. San Diego is really heavily populated with veterans. There's from various wars, including the current wars, and we need to treat our veterans with respect for their service to our country, and that's not happening either. And then, of course, a big one with me is obviously environmental issues, because as a biology major, a wildlife biology major, I can tell you it's all tied together. And if we don't keep our air and our water clean, it's going to increase healthcare costs. It's going to increase standard or reduce standard of living, and people should start looking at it as it is a priority. This earth we live on is a closed environment. The more we pollute, it's just going to stay up there and eventually suck us up. So that needs to be fixed. We need to be mindful when we're building communities of the future that the environment is an integral part of our society. It's not something that we can push off for another 10, 20 years.
Right. Has the primary started out there yet?
June 5th is the primary, and the top two vote-getters will go. There's currently, I said, 7 people running, and I'm polling number 3, which is good for only starting 2 months ago.
I think so. And what I want to do is I want to come back, say, like the middle of next month. I want to know where you're at and what you're doing. You and Christian both come on and talk to our listeners. As a matter of fact, our primary is May 8th, so we'll be finished with them. So, you know, maybe that the following week after that, we'd have you on the show again and tell us where you're at.
Great.
That'd be great, Mike.
If your listeners want to just read up on me, they can, if I may, go to my website.
Okay.
It's johnbrooksforcongress.com, and there's links to Facebook. There's feeds I put on. My whole platform's listed there. This is a self-funded campaign. I believe in it enough that I put my own money into running and getting the message out there. Like I said, big money has a big influence on politicians. I don't want to be one of those people. I want to work for the people and really be a voice for the people who are not being heard.
Okay. And I want to thank you. And theme song is coming up. And I want to thank John Brooks. John, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
John Brooks and Christian Snyder for being on the show. And we'll be hearing from you in about 3 weeks.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Michael.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Thanks.
Yes, that was John Brooks and Christian Snyder out on the left coast. And my gosh. 23%, 28% unemployment. We need everybody listening out there in North Carolina to write a letter to the Council of Review, write your congressman, your state senator, and your state representative, and tell them to tell David Parker, go. Resign now. We cannot have this man sitting in that office when the President of the United States steps off the plane onto the tarmac next week. He needs to make up his mind now. He's got to go. And that's been the last word.
So if I take independence to Billy Graham, and I take Billy Graham right into Wilmington, okay, so if I take a Billy Graham, I take that into where? Well, that's Wilkerson, it goes just all the way at the end. Right? And then when I get up there, I must be close by.
Whether you like the president on a personal level or not, if he's a good guy, a good husband or not, if you don't think you've got the task of turning the economy around, then it doesn't matter. In the fact that in the same poll that showed this race basically tied, that Romney's payment fake numbers are so bad, and yet so people are saying, you know, I don't like it. I don't think he's growing, but I'm ready for it.
Yeah,
you're not doing better because these people over here are doing too well. It's just kind of acknowledge my
Facebook. Yeah, but you know what it is? Because I need to have the number that you call and see. When I need that number, then I'll see. Because I, what I need to do is, this is all new. I need to put a name with the number. So we have to, I haven't done that yet. So, and I'll know next time.
Thank you.
Introducing Bold Choice, the premium that only earns to keep the car in reserve or simply choose another. And it's free. Now, this is another one we can help with the speed of hurts. There's one thing that strikes the chord with Massachusetts voters. We all know it's the Red Sox. Becoming Senator Scott Dunn has been going all out quoting Red Sox Nation recently with radio and WebEx featuring the senator reading fans' areas at Fenway. But has Brown crossed over to the dark side to the hated New York Yankees? Apparently, Yankees President Randy Levine has shut off a maximum donation to Brown's re-election campaign, $25,000, making $2,500. A cop in the Boston Herald doesn't give the Republican incumbent a free pass for accepting it either. Quote, that's right. The commander of the evil empire is hoping to take role with Brown as chasing his support to the Red Sox. It's one thing to be bipartisan center, but this is taking a little too far. There's no compromising in baseball. And now the Yankees honcho is playing for Scott Brown. Hey, what's that? Derek Jeter endorsing him? Well, we're thinking for Brown's spokesman says the kind of goofy contribute says, quote, their way of paying us back. For Babe Ruth. Well, also, how did Mitt Romney get on the wrong side of a small bakery in Pittsburgh and the 7-Eleven chain hold the same sentence? Think about what happened when Romney joined locals for a picnic. Let's do this.
I'm not sure about these cookies. Yeah, what they don't look like. You made them. You make them every day. Oh, no. They came from the local 7-Eleven bakery, you remember?
Wow, why those cookies? Well, the cookies in question were a special addition to the cookie, thanks to a very popular local bakery, the Bethel Bakery. Romney Thomas did not sit well with the owner, who said this. We wanted him to be walking with the best of the birds. He had no idea. This guy has no idea how beloved this institution is to provide those cookies. Wow. Romney left his mark on that town. One of today's featured items at the Bethel Bakery was called the Cookie Being Special. Buy one dozen, get six on the house. As for 7-Eleven, they plan to send some sample cookies to Romney's headquarters. Finally, Florida Republican Alan McCoy, a piece of work, is still under fire for insisting that from 78 to 81 House Democrats are communists, really communists. Plus, he's asked to get specific in an interview with CNN's fabulous interview that's sold out of Brian Blumberg.
I'm calling it this communist, progressive, Marxist, socialist, statist, which is another term that's been used. I'm looking at the ideologies, I'm looking at the things that they believe in. We need to stay at the border on a constitutional republic. And I think that a lot of people need to study that and understand what it is.
Well, this guy was either a no-show in history class or he's a wannabe demagogue. You decide. Up next, new details from the Secret Service sex scandal coming up during Hardball, including what really happened that night at that hotel. We're going to talk to the reporter who actually interviewed the escort. That's her title at the center of the story. Next, watch Hardball.
Once per year, while you pay significantly more interest on a 30-year fix, tomorrow the same amount of money for the next 7 years. With our 7-to-1 adjustable rate mortgage, you don't have to. Call today or go online to quickenloans.com to learn more about our 7-to-1 adjustable rate mortgage. And we're proud to announce that for the second year in a row, Jane Collins Associates ranked Quicken Loans highest in customer satisfaction in the United States for primary mortgage origination. Because here at Quicken Loans, everything we do is engineered to amaze.
He's got to go. I said on my show today, he has got to go.